From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign.
Made possible in part by Justin Wood, Paul Stevens, Tim Smith, Scott Harms, and Mark Soderberg of Archer Financial Services in Oakland, Illinois, a full-service commodities firm. You can learn more about the services they offer at 800-637-3123.
From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 15th day of July 2013. I'm Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Kurt Kimmel. He's at Bates Commodities in Normal, Illinois. And then Peter Goldsmith, the director of the Food and Agriculture Program here at the College of ACES in ACE, that stands for Agricultural and Consumer Economics, will be along to discuss his work. And we'll talk a little bit about some trading terms. Just as a reminder, I am out of the office this week, traveling with the National Soybean Research Lab in Haiti.
Support for WILL Agriculture comes from Murray Wise Associates, LLC. Land auctions, farm management, financial services, and institutional and corporate real estate. Information on upcoming land auctions can be found at murraywiseassociates.com.
I'm traveling this week with the National Soybean Research Lab to Haiti and out of the office. We'll update the numbers in just a few moments. Just as a reminder, there are several ways that you can pick up our programming. You can find us online at willag.org. That's willag.org. And if you try to hit that with your smartphone, it'll shape right down and fit your screen. If you don't like that version, we have a secondary version of our mobile website, and that's called m.willag.org. There is no www in front of that when you type it into your smartphone. It's actually http://m.willag.org. Speaking of the phone, you can always dial in at this number, 217-333-3434, each and every business day. Should be updated at about 10:15 and 3:15 with either the opening numbers from the CME Group in Chicago, that happens about 8:30 a.m. now, or the closing numbers and a bit of analysis. Either way, you can dial in at about 10:15 and 3:15 daily for a little listen to what's been happening in the marketplace at 217-333-3434. It's all part of the service that comes to you from willag.org, agricultural programming here at the home radio station since 1936. The current programming, by the way, was developed in 1985. We sure are glad to be here. Glad you're online with us, too. So stay with us as we make our way through this edition of the Closing Market Report. For this 1 week, we'll add a regular feature to the Closing Market Report. We call it Trading Terms. Our term for the day is futures contract, or just futures. It is a standardized contract between two parties to buy or sell a specified asset of a standardized quantity and or quality for a price agreed upon today, the futures price, with delivery and payment occurring at a specified future date, the delivery date. The contracts are negotiated at a futures exchange, which acts as an intermediary between the two parties. The party agreeing to buy the underlying asset in the future, the buyer of the contract, is said to be long, and the party agreeing to sell the asset in the future, the seller of the contract, is said to be short. While the futures contract specifies a trade taking place in the future, the purpose of the futures exchange institution is to act as the intermediary and minimize the risk of default by either party. Thus, the exchange requires both parties to put up an initial amount of cash, the margin. Additionally, since the futures price will generally change daily, the difference in the prior agreed-upon price and daily futures price is settled daily also. That's called variation margin. The exchange will draw money out of one party's margin account and put it into the other so that each party has the appropriate daily loss or profit. If the margin account goes below a certain value, then a margin call is made, and the account owner must replenish the margin account. By the way, the Chicago Board of Trade listed the first ever standardized exchange-traded forward contracts in 1864, which were called futures contracts. This contract was based on grain trading and started a trend that saw contracts created on a number of different commodities, as well as a number of futures exchanges set up around the world. And that's the definition of futures contract.
Agricultural programs are made possible by Risk Management Commodities Incorporated, headquartered in Lafayette, Indiana, with branches in Chalmers, Indiana, and Hudsonville, Illinois, providing independent commodity, financial, and currency analysis to its clients and newsletter subscribers. On the web at myrmconline.com.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. I'm Todd Gleason, traveling this week with the National Soybean Research Lab and its World Initiative on Soy and Human Health program, looking at food and nutrition feeding programs in the nation of Haiti. More on that next week.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Now here's Kurt Kimmel, the senior grains analyst at Bates Commodities, with an update of the closing numbers from the CME Group in Chicago and a bit of analysis. Kurt?
Well, good afternoon. Grain markets finished mixed on the day. September corn was down 9.25 cents a bushel at 5.36 1/4. December corn down 5 3/4 at 5.03 1/2. And next year's December corn down 6 3/4 at 5.28. Soybean prices closed higher. The August up 24 3/4 at 14.53 3/4. The November's up 6.5 cents at 12.63 3/4. In November next year, up 12 1/4 at 12.33 1/2. Wheat futures closed lower to December, down 11.5 cents at 6.82. The livestock markets are trading higher. August cattle up 67 at 122.52. The August hogs up 72 at 95.65. Looking at some of the other markets, crude oil is up 40 cents in the August at 106.35. August natural gas up 31 at 36.75. Gold futures in August up $6 an ounce at 12.83.60. The December silver up 12 cents at 19.97. The dollar index is up 4 at 83.20. And the bonds up 23 at 134.21. Grain markets closed mixed on the day. We saw an announcement that sold 120,000 tons of corn to unknown destination. Export inspections came in about as expected, 16.2 million bushels. They were looking anywhere from 14 to 19 million bushels. We need to average about 13.4. The good to excellent categories expected to jump anywhere from 1 to 2%. In the good to excellent readings, with pollination anywhere from 17 to 20% complete. The bulk of the pollination looks to come in this July 18th to the 30th. Average is about 36% this time of year, with 68% last year. Technical picture, looking for support here in the December corn right at the $5 level. If we can hold here in the overnight trade, look for a little bit of a short covering bounce back up to the 520 area. Bean crush came in this morning at 119 million bushels. Trade was looking anywhere from 114 to 116 million bushel. Bean oil stocks came in at 2.3 billion bushels, and that was about expected. Bean demand remained strong in the old crop. This is going to promote the bull spread activity here over the near term. Export inspections came in at 3.6 million bushels. Trade was looking anywhere from 2 to 5 million bushels. We need to average about 5.3 to meet the USDA export goal. Bean conditions are expected to be anywhere from steady to 2% better this afternoon. Looking at Delta harvest progressing, anywhere from four to six weeks down the road here. And they might have to use some defoliant to get that a little bit more speeded up. Technical picture for beans, November met the downside target here around 1250. Technicals are looking for a turn here over the next few days for beans to kind of take over leadership, for November beans try to bounce back up to this 1275 level. Wheat futures, lower wool values, especially in Russia, looking at Egypt trying to gain some export credit to buy some world wheat. Rains in Australia helped those drier regions quite a little bit. Export inspections on wheat came in anywhere from 17 to 21 million bushels, with 24.4 being announced, which was better than expected. Wheat market is looking for a seasonal low, seasonal traders are going to be due to come into the marketplace and buy wheat, sell corn, buy wheat, and maybe sell beans on the spread in here. The overall picture is somewhat bottom for wheat. Cattle market, hog market higher, renewed beef demand came in and supported the market. Basis is firming on the beef sector. Looking at technically on the cattle chart, we are looking at a head and shoulders bottom. So if we can see demand pick up in through here, cattle obviously run up to the 125 level. Hogs, bellies continue to be the preferred cutout value. The big thing in the hog complex is to continue to watch Asia's purchase of Smithfield. That's the look at the markets. I'm Kirk Kimmel with Bates Commodities in Normal, Illinois.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason, out of the office this week, traveling with the National Soybean Research Lab to the nation of Haiti. More on that adventure online at willag.org if all is working well while I'm out of country, and of course next week when I return here to the United States. Today, however, we'll hear the first in a series of interviews I did with Peter Goldsmith, the director of the Food and Agribusiness Program at the University of Illinois. As we began our conversation, I asked him to relate a notable achievement.
Yeah, one thing is the subdiscipline of agribusiness management is a relatively new field, and I took over the editorship of the flagship journal of the field, called the International Food and Agribusiness Management Review. And that was kind of a fledgling sort of publication. And now we receive over 14,000 articles are now downloaded. These are scientific articles every month from the journal. And we have the fastest growing, for scholars, impact factor in the field of agricultural economics and agribusiness. So we've really put this journal on the map and created a destination for scholars and set a bar for scholars in the field of agribusiness where there wasn't one before.
So the journal collects articles from academics around the nation or the world?
Well, it used to be very Euro and U.S. centric. We are an international journal, and so now we have submissions from all over the globe, which is really important because many of the exciting phenomena in the field of food and agribusiness is occurring in among emerging countries. And you want the scholars that are there, the scientists that are there, to study and write about them. And they wouldn't be part of a peer review process, the scientific process, if it weren't for a journal like ours. And so it brings them kind of to an international level, raises the standard, and brings those phenomena to light because we wouldn't see them. So understanding activities, trends, and so forth in emerging countries generally would not be known before, but now the journal provides an important outlet for those scholars.
Are journals like this generally just read by the academics they're targeted to?
That's a good question because ours is a little bit different. Our editorial philosophy is very simple. It's articles that are relevant to management scholars or managers. And so we accept both types of articles. So we have scientific articles. We have lots of case studies. We also have industry commentary, industry interviews. So we publish a number of things. We did just recently, one of our most successful special issues was on the issue of human capital in the food and agribusiness sector. There's a big, if you talk to leading CEOs of agribusiness companies, they are very frustrated by the lack or the difficulty of acquiring talent. Young executives and so forth, and they tend to be maybe second or third tier sorts of employees, where the first tier goes off to finance or some other sector, and they wonder why that is, and they want to bring show that food and agriculture is a very exciting area to be involved in, high tech, sophisticated, and so forth. And so this was a series of essays that were only 1,000 words, or they weren't scientific manuscripts. About 25 of them that we published a year ago for an international conference. And people like Hugh Grant, CEO of Monsanto, wrote an essay. Head of supply chain management for Nestle's, a gentleman named Hans Jahr. I mean, these kinds of people wrote articles raising this issue about human capital and how we bring human capital, high quality human capital, into the food and agribusiness space. And so we provide that service as well. So that would be, that's pretty exciting when you can really impact the major players and the major issues of the day through your work as a faculty member.
Is it subscription-based?
It's open access. We made it open access when I became the editor. I asked our board of directors. I thought that was a good idea, and we did. And we're electronic, so it's very accessible because, I had a very strong vision that we needed to be much more international. We needed much more focused or balanced with emerging countries and emerging country issues. And subscriptions and book form, really very expensive and not conducive. So, and it's working. And so we have managing editors, people who work for me all around the globe now from emerging countries. So it's really become an international, a truly international journal. And it's kind of cool just at a little old Mumford Hall, you know, a little enterprise like that. And I mean, there are a lot of other people involved. It's not just me, but some, the editor, executive editor. It's kind of, I'm the responsible party.
What's the web address?
If you Google IFAMR, that's all you need to put in and it'll pop right up. So that's the name and it'll pop right up.
Peter, let's go a little bit further back in your agribusiness career. Why is it that you were attracted to this area of study?
I was working in industry at the time, working for a co-op. Became very clear that the co-ops were very different from what I learned in business school, and that got me quite intrigued. And it was, during the 90s, it wasn't a... it was a rough time for agriculture, for all sectors. And so it was a rough time for co-ops, a lot of consolidations, a lot of buyouts, a lot of bankruptcies. We were a dairy co-op, so we weren't any luckier than anyone else. It was very hard times. And so you could see the strains on the co-op model. And so that, I just had a lot of questions sitting at my desk. And somehow as you mature, something changes. You stop being a businessman and you say, geez, I'd like to do research, even though I didn't really know what research was.
But Peter Goldsmith found out. We'll learn how and why tomorrow on the Closing Market Report. It's time to define a marketing term. Commodity broker, analyst, and author of Mastering the Grain Markets, Elaine Cubb, joins us. She believes the key to profitable grain trading is building knowledge about the fundamental practices of the industry. Today, she's here to help us define and understand cash grain contracts. Elaine, let's start with the basics.
Well, the basics of a cash grain contract that make it more interesting or more complex, let's say, than just a futures contract where you're just buying 5,000 bushels of grain, a cash grain contract can really dive into all of the specifics of a particular sample of grain. So this truckload of grain has, you know, a certain amount of moisture in that grain, or the wheat has a certain amount of protein in it, or it may have damage issues. It may have, you know, more foreign material in it than another sample. So that becomes more complex because you're not talking about a standard substance. You're talking about a specific thing, and that opens up a lot of trading opportunities for you.
So you need, as a producer or a seller of these products, to know what the elevator wants when you're negotiating a price?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one of the reasons why I included it in the book, is just because obviously if you're already trading the cash grains, if you're a farmer, you know what's on the contracts that you're trading. but to think of it like the grain merchandisers think of it, or perhaps someone was going to read this book thinking about going into the industry or not familiar with what the industry is doing. So how do they think about it? How do they think about the arbitrage opportunities that are available of buying dry grain? How is that worth more to me than drying wet grain, for instance? So that was one of the reasons why I included it, but also because speculators that are thinking about, you know, just these broad market movements, just your futures contract or futures charts, they also need to be thinking about what the industry is doing and how broad quality concerns can have an effect on a futures price. Like, for instance, this year, there was the aflatoxin situation through a lot of the Eastern Corn Belt, and you wouldn't necessarily think that that's affecting futures prices, and I wouldn't say that we've necessarily seen it do that yet. But for instance, when you hear stories of Europe canceling some shipments from the U.S., that doesn't necessarily mean that that's bearish because that's something about the broader market. That might just be a very specific quality concern for that specific barge load of grain. So thinking about these little subtle things that are going on in cash grain contracts can have an effect on your futures trading also.
How do you suppose discounts and premiums can be arbitraged to the advantage of your client?
Well, I'll tell you a story from when I was a cash grain merchandiser. At our elevator, we felt obliged one harvest. It was a very wet fall, very wet harvest, and we felt obliged to take a lot of grain from our clients, from our farmer clients that wanted to, you know, just get through harvest and get rid of this wet grain. So we took it wet and we had a giant pile of it and it all just turned black. It got heat damaged. We were holding on to a giant pile of bad corn, and there was no secret to it, right? It's sitting there right by the highway. Everybody in the county knew that this elevator had a bunch of bad grain. So the opportunities that opened up to the people who were trading with us is that any ethanol plants or anybody that we were selling to, they knew that we were trying to unload a bunch of grain, and they would be watching for it. So they could, in effect, penalize us in their basis bids to us. Farmers that were bringing in dry grain knew that we very badly needed good dry grain, so they could effectively demand a premium from us for it. So all of these things, you know, if you know this about your counterparties, the people that you're trading with, the things that they need to blend in, to mix and blend into their cash grain contracts, that can be an advantage when you're trading and negotiating an arbitrage trade.
Okay, and finally for today, what are the financial risks of handling grain?
This is, again, a matter of the quality. You know, when you think about a cash grain contract that can represent a certain specific sample of grain and the quality that it has and the problems that it has with it, when you're handling the grain, you really have to be aware of how shrink happens, for instance. If it's wet grain, you're going to find that the volume of it shrinks down more, so that will affect the total number of bushels in your elevator. You have to be aware of heat damage, other damage, any sort of aflatoxins, toxins that can grow within the grain while you're handling it. So there are a lot of risks for just hanging on to a physical quantity of grain that will be reflected in the cash grain context that you're trading that, you know, don't necessarily come into play if you're just playing with a futures contract that's just a standard 5,000 bushels of grain.
That's Elaine Cubb, broker, analyst, and author of Mastering the Grain Market. Stay with us here on the Closing Market Report. We'll be back in just 2 minutes from Illinois Public Media.
Support for agricultural programs comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
It's Key West Conch Fritter Day. On this day in agricultural history in 1752, Benjamin Franklin's kite-flying experiment proved that electricity and lightning were related. He did that while flying a kite with a key attached. In 1844, Charles Goodyear received another patent for an improvement in India rubber fabrics by adding white lead to the sulfur and heating method he patented in 1839. He had spent several years since going bankrupt in hardware trying to improve natural rubber, which became sticky in summer heat and brittle in the winter. He had experimented to coat it with a powder to make it less sticky when he accidentally dropped a mixture of natural rubber and powdered sulfur on a hot stove in Woburn, Massachusetts. The heat completed the process. Despite the value of his inventions, he died in poverty in 1860. In 1851, Jacob Fussell, a Baltimore dairyman, opened the first commercial ice cream factory. At that time, the average American ate less than 1 teaspoon of ice cream a year. By the way, the first recorded reference to ice cream in the New World was found in a journal entry dated 1744. It described a dinner party at the home of Maryland's governor, Thomas Bladen, who served a dessert of ice cream made with milk and strawberries. And that's this day in agricultural history.
This stock and commodity report is made possible with support from Bates Commodities in Normal. Bates Commodities can be reached at 1-800-383-4647 or on the internet at batescom.net.
You're listening to the Closing Mark Report from Illinois Public Media. Up next, the first in a four-part series on the history of corn.
Corn was first domesticated in Mexico between 4,500 and 7,000 years ago along the 18th parallel. It was flint corn. Somewhere around 1,000 BC, retired corn breeder Forrest Troyer says this early corn was moved into the area we now know as New Mexico and Arizona.
And then the dent corn came in after Columbus, probably Cortez, when he went to Tampa Bay, when he went to Tampa Bay, probably brought the first dent corn to the United States.
The critical thing about these two moves was that the corn, flint and dent, had to be adapted to longer days and cooler, shorter seasons. Now, dent has also been developed in Mexico, but much later than flint, probably about 1500 BC, says Troyer. So flint corn came into the southwestern part of the United States, and dent corn traveled much later into the eastern U.S. Dent corn was superior to flint in almost every respect. The kernels were larger and the yields were greater. Soon enough, European settlers in the New World recognized the two different kinds of corn were related and could be crossed.
And the flints were the source of earlier maturity that was needed, and the dents were the source of higher yield and also better feeding traits. So some number of people in Virginia and in Tennessee and Kentucky crossed flint by dents to develop varieties.
Generally, says Troyer, it is estimated that by the time most of the United States had been settled in the 1840s, about 250 different varieties of dent/flint crosses had been developed. The Corn Belt at that time still hadn't made its way northward. The prime growing states were Virginia, Kentucky, and Tennessee.
And the reason for that is that the land grants from the Revolutionary War from Virginia, the state of Virginia, and also the land grants that were issued to veterans of the Mexican War were virtually all in that area. There was a small area in southern Ohio on the Scioto River, but there were two areas in Tennessee and there's two areas in Kentucky, and of course the corn in Virginia was already there. I mean, you know that they had already worked with it before the movement west started.
It is the combination of what American Indians did in bringing flint corn north into the U.S. and what European settlers did with dent corn on the East Coast that has resulted in the hybrids grown today by farmers in the new Corn Belt, Nebraska, Iowa, Missouri, Illinois, Indiana, and Ohio. As farmers settled those states, they brought the 250 dent-flint crosses northwestward with them. Those open pollinated crosses, the dent-flint combinations, were quickly adapted to the growing conditions of the Midwest.
And that wraps up this Monday edition of the Closing Market Report. Be sure to visit us online at willag.org. I'm Todd Gleason.